Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, OMA Chief Science Officer Dr. Harold Bays leads an article review with an industry expert. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, a clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Hello. My name is Dr. Harold Bays, Medical Director and President of the Louisville Metabolic and Atherosclerosis Research Center, located in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm also Chief Science Officer of the Obesity Medicine Association. I'm also Editor-in-Chief of Obesity Pillars, which is the official journal of the Obesity Medicine Association. And welcome to this podcast entitled Obesity, a Disease. This is the official podcast of the Obesity Medicine Association. And for those that have listened to prior podcasts, they know that what I like to focus upon is I like to focus on recent articles, you know, get experts to comment on recent articles and publications, preferably in the Obesity Pillars. And the article for which today's program is focused upon is this joint statement that was entitled Obesity, Dyslipidemia, and Cardiovascular Disease, a Joint Expert Review from the Obesity Medicine Association and the National Lipid Association. And I don't often do this, but I do want to read all the authors because this was a lot of work. So yes, I was co-author. Also had Carol Kirkpatrick, Kevin Mackey, Peter Toth, Ryan Morgan, Justin Taunt, Dave Dixon, and Terry Jacobson. Now, one of the things we really like to try to do is to talk to an author of one of these papers, and we are so fortunate to have one of the authors, Sandra Christensen. Sam, why don't you tell the people who you are and what you do?
Hi, thanks, Harold, for having me today. I'm excited to talk about this topic. I am an obesity specialist, and I've been treating obesity for nearly two decades. I own my own practice in Seattle, Washington, Integrative Medical Weight Management, and I serve on the Board of Trustees of the Obesity Medicine Association, and I'm the incoming president of the Washington Obesity Society, and I also serve on the editorial board of Obesity Pillars.
Well, then, obviously, that would make you, a pretty good person to represent the article and engage in discussions. For those of you that remember, I think most of you do, Sam was also the first author of a clinical practice statement regarding psychiatric disease and obesity. And I see a lot of analogies between this paper and that one in that, there is a lot of granularity in this joint review, but I think there's a lot of clinical application as well. And I think one of the real values of both of these papers, we're able to take material and content that I think is just, it was just, scattered across the internet, and we were able to consolidate them all into one article, the one article for which Sam was first author of the Obesity and Psychiatric Disease Clinical Practice Statement. Again, consolidated a lot of the information out there. And this one in particular, I can give you some insight that, golly, I think, maybe over 60% of the content of this article came from research done in the 1970s that people just don't even cite anymore. So again, it's very foundational. So if you're looking for a really good foundational article review, I think this is as good as it gets. So let's just start, Sam, let's just start at the very basics. I think a lot of clinicians out there, particularly obesity medicine clinicians, maybe you're curious about how does obesity contribute to dyslipidemia?
Yeah, so what I'll say first is that as an obesity specialist, when I see a patient, I'm thinking about how is their excess adiposity affecting their health? Like how much of it is there? Where is it on their bodies? And what is the health of it? And that really plays into how it contributes to dyslipidemia. So we know that adipocytes store the majority of the body's energy as triglycerides and cholesterol, and that when there is an you know, excess amount of fat. We see hyperplasia of the fat cells, hypertrophy of the fat cells, and then the expansion of the adipose tissue. And when that happens, it can compromise the blood supply and cause those cells to become hypoxic and sick. And so it's those sick fat cells that really contribute to the dyslipidemia that we see with obesity. And we call that adipose-apothic dyslipidemia, which is atherosclerotic in nature.
Well, so let's just get right to that. So when you say adipose-apathic dyslipidemia, can you be a little bit more specific? Like what sort of lipid abnormalities, say a clinician orders a lipid panel, what would be the typical lipid pattern that you might see in a patient who has the obesity, particularly if they have the type 2 diabetes mellitus? What would be a standard or a typical type of lipid pattern you would see in such folks?
So you're probably going to see elevation in the triglycerides and suppressed HDL. The LDL-C tends to be kind of a mild to moderate elevation. And then cholesterol can kind of be same, you know, moderate to or mild to moderate. But I learned early on about the importance of ordering advanced lipid testing and learning more about the lipoproteins in the blood, primarily LDL-P. So looking at the particle number and then the size of them. So there's small, dense, and kind of a larger size. And so the makeup of that, so someone who has more LDL particles and smaller, denser particles, that's going to be more atherogenic. And so the way I think about that is that the little small, dense particles are like little BBs, and they can like nick the blood vessels or embed in them. And then we causes, you know, inflammation. And the large ones are kind of fluffy, more like a cotton ball. They're atherogenic, but not as much as the small, dense ones. And so those are things that I look at when I'm evaluating a patient.
Right. And I think the thing that people sometimes get confused about is for the same. So you mentioned that many times in patients with obesity, maybe LDL cholesterol is mildly to moderately elevated, but not markedly so, not like you would think. Mm-hmm. But what happens is for the same level of LDL cholesterol, so you order a panel, you see the LDL cholesterol, it's mild to moderately elevated, but for the same LDL cholesterol blood level you see on your lab sheet, the person with the obesity, the person with the type 2 diabetes mellitus, the person with the adipose-apathic dyslipidemia will have a greater number of LDL particles because their particles are smaller. And exactly what you just said, that's a more atherogenic, you know, profile. And, you know, Sam, I just don't know that people really appreciate that in many cases, it's not just about the LDL cholesterol level in patients with obesity. It's their potential to generate atherosclerosis. I mean, would you agree with that?
I completely agree with that. Yeah. The LDL-C just tells you, you know, how much LDL there is in a volume of blood. It doesn't tell you anything about the distribution of it. And so what I'll say too is that early on, I routinely order the advanced lipid testing with patients. And then I kind of shifted to only doing it if the LDL-C was elevated. And after working on this paper, I've really gone back to the practice of doing it initially, because if you just look at that LDL-C, it can be misleading. And so it's better to look deeper. And then you can also measure how that improves as you help people reduce their weight.
Right. And so I think the essential message is for clinicians out there that maybe are not lipidologists is to say, look, LDL cholesterol is just simply the cholesterol found in LDL particles. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's not telling you the number of atherogenic particles. That can best be done by, as you mentioned, advanced lipid testing. Another really inexpensive way is to get what's called an ApoB. ApoB is an apolipoprotein where there's one molecule of ApoB on every atherogenic lipoprotein. And that includes not just LDL particles, but also triglyceride-enriched lipoprotein particles, which, as you mentioned, elevation triglyceride, you know, that does happen. in patients with the obesity. So measuring an ApoB is going to give you a sense about the number of atherogenic particles. Doing advanced lipid testing is going to help you out and those types of things. So that's on the diagnostic side. But what about the therapeutic side? So now we have, in the past year or so, these treatment with the glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist, the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And I'm not going to put you on the spot here and ask you, what you believe the main cardiovascular benefits of GLP-1 receptor agonists. I mean, that's probably a conversation that would be an entire symposium. But suffice it to say that, you're getting weight reduction, improvement in glucose metabolism, reduction in blood pressure, improvement in lipids, maybe reduction in inflammation, and maybe there's direct vascular effects with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And it's just really impossible, at least it is for me, to tether all these things out and ask which one is most clinically relevant. But I would just simply say is that, there are improvements in all these things with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And my question to you is, to what degree do these GLP-1 receptor agonists improve not just the metabolic, not just the weight of patients, not just the metabolic profile of patients, but to what degree do GLP-1 receptor agonists reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease?
So with that weight reduction, we often see the triglycerides go down. We'll see the HDL go up. We have a variable effect with the LDL-C. And so I don't know that we have full evidence on this, but the way I think of it is, when there's this excess fat in the body, it gets distributed, perivascular ectopic fat, visceral fat, epicardiac fat, fat in all those organs. And so I think of the that fat disappearing or being reduced, and then all that atherogenic, the adipokines, cytokines that were coming from them, plus the way they impair the function of the blood vessels and the heart and all the organs as the way that health improves and the way we reduce the cardiovascular risk for someone.
And I'm sorry, so I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but would you say that, so we have evidence from semaglutide, from the SELECT trial with the semaglutide, that getting a, 20% relative risk reduction in, cardiovascular disease events. Would you at least concede that it's possible that some of that risk reduction could be improvement in lipids? Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. We see triglycerides go down pretty significantly. With the people in the SELECT trial, they had over 18% reduction in the triglycerides and then increase in their HDL. So absolutely. And that's what I'm saying about that ectopic fat produces all these adipokines, cytokines, inflammatory, and these triglyceride-rich proteins, lipoproteins that affect cardiovascular risk.
And so when we're managing our patients with the obesity, taking about what you said, one of the things I think that we really tried to say in this paper is that it is true that you're going to achieve some clinically meaningful weight reduction. It is true that you're going to get some improvement in lipids with, again, drugs like the semaglutide. I'm picking that because it's got this is the drug that was used in the SELECT trial. I don't know that we can just stop there. I think that patients with the obesity are as deserving of cardiovascular disease risk reduction as a person without the obesity, and such that when you look at a patient who's either had cardiovascular disease or who's at very high risk for cardiovascular disease, and they have elevations in their LDL cholesterol, say above 130, or maybe for some people greater than 100 milligram per deciliter, or for some people greater than 70 milligrams per deciliter or whatever, they still are at atherosclerotic risk, even if they go on a drug like semaglutide. What is your sense about the need to have a dual approach where, yes, you're going to try to achieve weight reduction and some improvement in lipids with drugs like semaglutide, but oh, by the way, our patients with the obesity are just as deserving and just as needy for drugs like statins as a person without obesity. First of all, do you agree with that? And then the second point is, how do we get that message out?
Yeah, I agree completely with what you're saying. And so we know that excess adiposity can contribute to dyslipidemia and increased cardiovascular risk, but so can other factors for someone, right? They can have the genetics. And so while we say treat obesity first, we don't say only treat obesity, right? Like you treat obesity first and you treat the other issues that are there and you have to be able to identify them. And these new meds that we have now are really helping with that, right? Like you're mentioning the SELECT trial, seeing a 20% reduced risk in major adverse cardiovascular events. We've also got the HFpEF trials with semaglutide that show with people with diabetes, people without, that show weight reduction and improved physical function. And I'm guessing, but I don't know, that it's reducing that epicardiac fat that could be impairing the heart's ability to function. And then even in the tirzepatide trial for SURMOUNT-1, we see significant reduction in triglycerides, increase in HDL. So triglycerides like around 25%, HDL almost 9%. And so again, we don't know, is it all about weight reduction or is there an action of the medication that's also improving that profile?
I think my takeaway message from what you said, and then I'll let you tell me what your takeaway message is. But my takeaway is this. Look, it is true that the majority of cases of the type 2 diabetes mellitus and many cases of hypertension and also a lot of cases of dyslipidemia are in fact due to, as you mentioned, increased adiposity, in other words, increase in body fat and the adiposopathy, the sick fat that ensues. But it's not all of it, okay? Genetics plays a large role and other potential causes play larger roles. So it is true that, yes, you administer a GLP-1 receptor agonist, for example, but I'm talking about other anti-obesity medications as well. You administer an anti-obesity medication, yes, there can be an expectation that blood sugar is going to get better and hypertension is going to get better and the lipids are going to get better, but that doesn't mean it's going to fix it all. So I think just as we would in patients without obesity, I think we ought to be cautious and be diligent about managing our patients with the obesity and make sure that they're achieving the same sort of goals with regard to these other metabolic parameters, particularly if they're cardiovascular disease risk factors and particularly if the patient's at high cardiovascular disease risk. The patient with the obesity is just deserving of cardiovascular disease risk prevention as a person without obesity. So what would you say would be your takeaway message with regard to this, again, this joint expert review on obesity, dyslipidemia, and cardiovascular disease?
Yeah, well, I agree with what you just said that, and I would almost say more deserving, right? Because obesity itself increases cardiovascular risk. So we want to do everything we can to reduce that and reduce other health risks as well. And so the takeaway that I would say from this article is recognize how the excess adiposity is affecting the health of your patient. Think about the atherogenic dyslipidemia that is a result of excess adiposity. Look at other factors as well. Implement a comprehensive treatment plan that includes healthful nutrition, physical activity, anti-obesity medications if indicated, even consider bariatric surgery. And that's how you're going to reduce the cardiovascular risk of your patients. The other thing I think about a lot with my patients is insulin resistance, and you've mentioned that, and really reducing that also reduces the risk. But we want to do everything we can for our patients with obesity to reduce cardiovascular risk.
Well, I think that's a great way to end this topic here. So, Sam, thank you so much. That was truly outstanding. I think that's a good overview. Now, admittedly, the original articles, it's got a lot more information. So this is just the very tip of the iceberg. And I would encourage those of you that are interested to look this up. It's free online. And again, it's entitled Obesity, Dyslipidemia, and Cardiovascular Disease. Sam, thank you so much. I think a lot of people are really going to benefit from this discussion. And again, I just want to say my name is Harold Bays, and you've been listening to Obesity, a Disease.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.